1 Samuel 18, if you have your Bibles, and I hope that you do. In fact, I think we ought to be sort of a responsive reading here kind of thing. I'll say, you know, I always say the Bible, and then you say, if you have your Bibles, and you say, and you hope that we do. That will probably be pretty predictable. But 1 Samuel 18, as you are turning there, 1 Samuel 18, back in 2010, Burger King ran a Facebook ad, the campaign in which they offered a coupon for a free Whopper to anybody who would unfriend at least 10 of their Facebook friends. The marketing scheme was when you unfriended the person, then Burger King would send them a Facebook notification that they had been unfriended for a delicious hamburger, which was supposed to make you say, well, wow, this burger must really be something if I got booted as a friend over it. Brilliant, right? Thank you, Burger King, for making our world a little brighter place for us to live in. Well, the New York Times reported that the stunt worked too well. Within the first week, 233,906 friendships had been terminated, and Burger King was on the hook for 23,000 free Whoppers. They immediately discontinued the ad. Now, I know Facebook friends are not always real friends, but I do think that the success of that ad highlights a genuine issue in our culture. And that is that friendship is just not that much of a highly valued commodity anymore. A recent survey asked respondents here in the United States, in the last six months, with how many people have you, outside of your family, have you deeply discussed an important matter, a personal matter? Over half of the people surveyed could not come up with a single person that they had discussed these kind of deeper issues with outside of their family. This seems to be an especially serious problem for men. Most men stop making friends after they get married. I mean, think about it. Can you name your dad's close friends? Did you name your dad's close friends? Not people he worked with or people he hung out with, but I mean like close friends. Most men don't have these relationships, particularly as they get older. When men are connected at all, it's usually on superficial things. Work, sports, poker, hunting, something like that. Only 1 in 10 men in this survey had somebody outside of his family with whom he discussed issues related to money or life or kids or marriage. Only 1 in 20 had a friendship in which they disclosed information about how they were feeling or if they were distressed. 1 Samuel 18 is all about friendship. And in this message, I'm going to make some pointed applications specifically toward men. If you are a man in here today, why don't you just raise your hand, okay? So I know exactly where to aim, okay? I'm applying this to men specifically for two reasons. Number one, the story is about the friendship of two men. Secondly, men, we are especially bad at this. Ladies, I promise, there's plenty of good stuff in here for you too. But you're a little better at this, just sort of naturally. And if we men, we could get the men in here straight on this, we'd all be better off, amen? All right, 1 Samuel 18, again. Listen, I hope that all of our messages here are important. But some messages define who we are as a church. Who we are as a church. This is a core Summit message for us because one of the things that we really desire here at the Summit Church is we desire to be a community of friends. We say that church should not be an event that we attend. It ought to be a community, a family that we belong to. Now, I just want to acknowledge making friendships, making deep friendships in a place like this can be difficult because it's possible in a church this size just to sort of slip in and out of a place like this and remain anonymous. But we want to be a community that you belong to, not an event you attend. So one of our goals here, you'll hear us say it, is we want to help the church grow bigger and smaller at the same time. Bigger in that we reach more people, but also smaller in that we make it easy for people to connect and be known. But to do that is gonna take some initiative on your part. Here's a question. How many of you have been at our church for less than a year? Why don't you raise your hand? If you've been at our church for less than a year, all right. If you're grateful these people are here, put your hands together, excited about that, all right? But here is the deal. For those of you that just raised your hand, they say, every study they've done says that unless you know 7 people by name at the end of that first year, you likely will not be back for a second. Unless you know and, you know, can call 7 people by name And by the way, I don't count as one of those unless you know how to spell my last name, and then I would count, okay? But I don't count as one of those. But unless you know seven people by name, you likely won't be back for that second year. And so one of our goals is to help you be able to do that, but it's gonna take some initiative on your part. So consider today my biblical motivation for you to do that. 1 Samuel 18 is one of the great friendship stories of all time. It shows us not only why friendships are important, it also shows us how we can go about developing those friendships. And it weaves these beautiful lessons along the thread line of the main point of these David stories, and that is how God used David to prepare Israel for the Messiah. Okay, let's get to work. Verse one, and the soul of Jonathan, the son of Saul, was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Literally in Hebrew, it says they were knit together in one spirit. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David, and Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, and he gave it to David and his armor, even his sword and his bow and his belt. By the way, what were those things that he gave him? Those were his princely garments that he's giving to him. Here's what's remarkable about this. In normal circumstances, who would have become king after Saul? It would have been Jonathan, right? We know how this works. Queen Elizabeth, the beloved queen of England, when she passes, it is her son, Charles, that inherits the throne and becomes king. But Jonathan, though he was supposed to become king after Saul, he recognizes that God had chosen David to be the next king. And without the slightest hint of jealousy or resentment, Jonathan divests himself of his garments and he gives them to David. Verse 5, and David was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war as they were coming home when David returned from striking down the Philistine, Goliath. The women on one of these returns home, they came out singing and dancing. And the women sang, Saul has struck his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Now, just so you know, this was not supposed to favor David over Saul. In Hebrew poetry, it was common to have two statements that basically said the same thing, where the second statement intensified the first. Just read the book of Proverbs, you'll see this. For example, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking guile. That is not meant to contrast the wickedness that the tongue and the lips can do. The second phrase just reiterates and intensifies the first phrase. In the same way, these women are not trying to say that David is so much better than Saul. This is a song that is giving thanks to God for both of them. And they mentioned Saul first simply because Saul had been king first. But Saul did not like that his name was associated with the lower number. And so Saul said, they have ascribed to David his 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed mere thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? It's a little bit of a jump if you ask me, but verse 9, and Saul gave David the stink eye from that day on. Jump forward now to chapter 19 and go down to verse 8. And then there was war again, and David went out and fought again with the Philistines and struck them with a great blow so that they fled before him. Then after that, a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. David was playing the lyre, and Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear. But David, with his cat-like reflexes, eluded Saul. People complain that I never say anything positive about cats. That was a positive statement about cats. Eluded Saul, and the spear struck directly into the wall, and David fled and escaped that very night. Eventually, Saul's gonna cool down, and David's gonna come back, but in the next couple of chapters, Saul tries four more times to kill David. Saul vacillates back and forth, up on David one day, trying to turn him into a dartboard the next. When Saul goes on one of his murderous rages, Jonathan, his son, pleads David's case with his dad, saying, Dad, what has David ever done to you? You've had no better friend in your kingdom, Dad, than David. And that usually calms Saul down for a while, and they bring David back. But then, you know, after everything goes well for a little bit, Saul flips again, and this happens a total of five times. Well, after that fifth time, when David runs away, after a while, it seems like Saul has cooled down, but nobody knows for sure. And by the way, you think your job is hard? You probably did not go to work this week saying, I wonder if my boss is gonna try to kill me with a javelin this week, right? But that's David's life right now. Nobody knows for sure if Saul has calmed down. So David and Jonathan come up with a plan to test Saul to see what's in his heart. Here's the plan. David's gonna skip the monthly banquet that Saul has with all of his generals. And when Saul asks Jonathan where David is, Jonathan will tell him that David had a family issue come up that made him go home to Bethlehem. And they figure if Saul gets furious, then that reveals that he had a plan to kill David. Well, sure enough, when Jonathan relays the message to Saul, Saul becomes furious. And when Jonathan pushes back, y'all, just a little bit, says, hey, Dad, what's the big deal? Saul picks up the javelin and throws it at Jonathan. So there they got their answer. Saul clearly wants to kill David. So Jonathan goes out to David, who is hiding in the woods now, about 30 miles away from the palace. They have this little prearranged signal worked out. Jonathan shoots some arrows out into a field and tells his servant boy to go and retrieve those arrows. And David knows if he hears Jonathan tell the servant boy, the arrows are beyond you, well, that means David is in danger. But if he says the arrows are in front of you, well, that means David is safe. So Jonathan fires the arrows and he says, hey, boy, the arrows are way beyond you. So David knows that he is in mortal danger. Later, he finds David hiding out there in the woods. David rose from behind the stone heap where he was hiding and fell on his face to the ground and bowed 3 times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, because we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you and between my offspring and your offspring forever. And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. Y'all, there is so much good stuff about friendship in this story, but before we unpack those things, I want us to make sure that we do not lose the larger threads in this story. First, we are witnessing the complete unraveling of Saul. Saul is literally going insane. I know that mental health often has multiple causes, but Saul's insanity had a spiritual root. Disconnecting himself from God caused deep feelings of insecurity in him. No longer could he depend on God to be his shield and his sufficiency and to fight his battles. Saul now carried the weight of all those things. And that brought all kinds of anxiety. I mean, how could it not? If you're always worried about what tomorrow brings and if you're gonna be sufficient for it, how could that not make you anxious? Are you gonna be able to make ends meet? Being out of the will of God also made Saul jealous, because now everybody else is a potential threat. And Saul has to maintain his image by always being successful. And other people who might be more successful than him become a threat to his self-image. Everybody's a threat. So that makes him start acting insane. Proverbs 28:1 says this. By the way, the book of Proverbs, we know was written by Solomon, but most scholars think that Solomon got a lot of that wisdom from David. And so this likely originated with David. Psalm 28:1, Proverbs 28:1 says, the wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are bold as a lion. The wicked flees when nobody pursues. Doesn't that sound like an insane person? This is Saul. Everybody else is a threat. And it gives us a picture of every person who is out of the will of God. When you are the one responsible to maintain your identity, security, and happiness, when the weight of those things sits on your shoulders, you will live with a constant undercurrent of anxiety and envy. Again, how could you not? You might experience that as a low-grade hum in the back of your life, only popping out from time to time in the occasional sleepless night or panic attack. That envy might only come out every once in a while in the occasional unguarded, cutting, jealous comment that you make about a friend or to a friend. Or it could get really intense like Saul's does. Many of you live with this anxiety and jealousy. St. Augustine said that anxiety and envy and hatefulness toward others are like smoke from a fire that you can trace back down to the idolatrous altars that you have built in defiance of God. Anxiety and envy are not the primary problem. They are the fruits of the primary problem. The real problem is, like Saul, you have gotten disconnected from God and you've taken the weight of maintaining your identity, security, and happiness. You've taken the weight of those things onto you, which you were never designed to do. Trying to play the role of God in your life will make you insane. So don't just try to correct the fruits of the problem. Don't just read books on strategies to reduce your anxiety and stress. You've got to address the problem at the roots. You've got to surrender to God and lean on him in trust. So that's the first thread. We are seeing the unraveling of Saul. Here's the second thread to note about this passage. The author is using, catch this, the stories of Saul and Jonathan to illustrate, watch this, the two ways that we respond to God's anointed king. Saul rejects God's king because he's a threat and he tries to kill David to keep David off of his throne. Jonathan, however, gladly bows his knee to David, even though to do so, he had to give up all of his claims to the throne, and even though it caused a lot of strain in his family. Jonathan gives us a picture of what it will mean one day to surrender to King Jesus. Jesus said to come to him, we would have to walk away from our claim to the throne. We had to be willing to forsake even our father and mother if we wanted to become his disciples. So the question this whole story asks is, which one of those categories are you gonna be in? You gonna, like Saul, resist Jesus? Or are you gonna abdicate the throne of your heart to him? There are only two choices. You either bow before him and surrender, or you call out for his crucifixion. You're either like Jonathan or you're like Saul. Those are the two big threads from this story. But we're gonna spend the rest of our time focusing on the third thread, and that is the importance of friendship. We're gonna look at three things here. Number one, we're gonna look at the character of friendship. We're gonna look at the importance of friendship. And then number three, we're gonna look at the power behind friendship. Number one, here we go. The character of friendship, maybe more so than anybody else in the Bible. Jonathan demonstrates the character of a true friend. Now, several things I could comment on here. I made a list of a bunch of them. I'm only gonna focus on three. All right, if you're taking notes, letter A, selfless love. Selfless love. Jonathan loved David as his own soul, even though David inherited what in other circumstances would have come to Jonathan. Yo, how easy would it have been for Jonathan to have gotten jealous? In fact, every indication is Jonathan had not done anything wrong. His family lost the throne because his dad sinned, not him. How would you have responded to that? I can tell you how I would have responded. It would have been so tempting for me to say, that's not fair. It's not fair, God. And then to resent David because David got all the blessings that I wanted. But see, that wasn't Jonathan. Jonathan respected what God appointed and he genuinely loved David. So let me just ask you, how jealous are you of those that you call your friends? Are you secretly resentful when some blessing comes into their lives, when they get the boyfriend, when they get the starting position, when they get the good grade or the recognition or the promotion that you wanted? Are you resentful about how fabulous they look as they age? Why do they have so much money? Why are their kids excelling at school and getting scholarships while yours are struggling? And all you can do is look at them and think, God, why not me? They're not better than me. True friendship is selfless. It rejoices in the blessings that your friends get, even when those blessings are things that you would have liked to have had for yourself. Second characteristic you see in Jonathan's life, intentionality. Intentionality. Jonathan and David are not just two companions brought together by the happenstances of life. Work colleagues, golf buddies, pregnant at the same time, if they had been women, right? They're not just people brought together just, you know, because they happen to be together. Nor did they spend time together just because they made each other laugh or they enjoyed each other's company, though I'm sure that was true too. Do you notice it says in chapter 18, verse 3, first verses we read, did you notice it said they made a covenant? That's an extremely weighty Hebrew word. They made a covenant to look to each other, look after each other. They swore together, and they swore to do that even when it was terribly inconvenient. That means more than just being around each other. It means choosing to get involved in the things that mattered and talking about those things. We men have perfected this category of friendship where all we do is golf or hunt or play poker or watch sports together. And that's it. Women tend to be better at this, but guys can be together for hours. Never talk about anything substantive. The best guy that I've ever heard talk about this was the comedian Brian Regan. He does this bit recounting a conversation that he had with his wife. He says, I have this friend who got divorced. I went golfing with him recently, and it's the first time I'd seen him since the divorce. So when I got home, my wife was like, how's Carrie coping with the divorce? He's like, fine, I think. She said, well, I thought you went golfing with Gary today. I did. You don't know how he's doing with the divorce? It never came up. Is he dating anybody? I don't know. Were you two in the same golf cart? Yeah? You were in the same golf cart for 4 hours and you don't know if he's dating anybody? I know he's got a great new driver. How is that possible? How is it possible that how Gary's doing with the divorce wouldn't even come up? And Brian says, he says, how is it possible that it would have come up? Yeah, the 150 markers out there, I can say probably about 135. Are you dating anybody? You know, it's just not, it doesn't feel natural. Biblical friendships, by contrast, take intentionality. It's a choice to be involved in each other's lives and to get into the things that matter. Here's the third thing we see. Letter C, a commitment to speaking truth. Jonathan told David hard things, things that were awkward, things that David didn't want to hear. And that's because Jonathan was not simply trying to keep the peace or to make David feel good. He was trying to save David's life. A true friend thinks about your safety and your flourishing more than they do their comfort. And that means they're committed to telling you the truth, even when it hurts them or you. Again, through the book of Proverbs, wisdom that most likely came from David, Proverbs 27:6. Here's what David says, or here's what Solomon repeats David says. He says, blessed are the wounds of a friend, faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Y'all, kisses always feel better than wounds. And if you only have people around you who give you kisses, life will feel mostly good for a while. But it's the faithful wounds of a friend that end up saving your life. Those three things stand out about this friendship to me. Selfless love, intentionality, and a commitment to speaking truth. Those are the three things that will characterize all biblical friendship. Now, I wish I didn't have to say this next part, but I do, because this is the world we now live in. There are some who have tried to say that David and Jonathan must have been gay. So close and so intimate and so committed was this friendship. And I just want to say that it is sad to me that some people go there, because what that tells me is that our culture is so impoverished by friendlessness that we cannot imagine a loyal, loving connection with somebody without there being some sexual component to it. But the Bible frequently points to friendships that are loving and supportive and life-giving that are not sexual in any way. You say, well, how do you know it wasn't sexual? Well, two reasons. First, the writer presents David as somebody zealous to honor God's laws. And the Jewish law could not have been clearer on this. The writer would never present David as a man who upheld the law if David had this glaring inconsistency. Plus, we're gonna later see that the writer of 1 and 2 Samuel pulls no punches when David deviates from those laws. The idea that the writer is hinting around about him being gay is, quite frankly, ridiculous. And it's a prime example of reading the Bible with an agenda rather than just reading it on its own terms. We've got lots of references in ancient literature to same-sex relationships. They never read like this. Maybe more convincingly, however, is that David contrasts his love for Jonathan with sexual love. After Jonathan dies, here's what David says, 2 Samuel 1:26, I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. Now, at first you read that and you're like, whoa, that's intense. And it is intense. But notice that David is contrasting his love for Jonathan with sexual love. He's saying this is a different kind of love and commitment than sexual love, but it is real and it is significant. The temptation to read Jonathan and David's love as sexual love, again, just reveals how impoverished our culture is of the biblical concept of friendship. Y'all, we don't even have a category for this anymore. And that's a tragedy. We need this category of relationships. Both heterosexual people need it, and those with same-sex attraction need this kind of category that consists of genuine love and commitment that is not sexual. And that category is called biblical friendship, which leads me to number two. Number two, the importance of friendship. The importance of friendship. There are several things that this friendship provided for David. These are what true friendship does for us too. Letter A, again, if you're taking notes, this friendship shielded David. Jonathan alerted David to danger that David was unaware of. He saw things that David could not see. I love this verse in Ecclesiastes. Again, written by Solomon, wisdom might maybe coming from David. Two are better than one. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity the fool who falls alone and has nobody to help him up. If two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves, but a cord of three strands, that is not easily broken. Now, I will freely tell you, there is a part of that verse that does not speak to me. I'm not lying down with another dude to keep warm unless we are in the tundra and it is literally a matter of life and death. I have a strict no spooning rule with my friends, okay? But still, the central point is solid. Together is better. And that's partially because our friends see danger in our lives before we do. Y'all, the definition of a blind spot is something you can't see because you're blind to it. When I've challenged certain people on their lack of friends, sometimes they'll be like, why don't we have these blind spots? I'm like, if you knew they were there, they wouldn't be called blind spots. You can't see it, but your friends can. Often that blind spot is in your own heart. Proverbs 18:1, an isolated man ends up seeking his own desire and will rage against all sound judgment. When you get isolated, selfish heart deformities like weeds begin to grow unchecked. Think of it like the yard of a blind person. They wouldn't know where to pull up the weeds. That's what happens to an isolated man. The late David Pallison, a Christian counselor, used to paraphrase Proverbs 18:1 this way. He would say, things that grow in a secret garden always grow mutant. I've told you this before, but I think it bears repeating. I was speaking at a conference a few years ago with a guy named Paul Tripp, who's a Christian counselor who's been spoken here. Great guy, read all of his books. We were backstage, and news had just come out that week on yet another one of these mega pastors. A good guy who had fallen. I can't remember exactly what it was in his case, abusing power, inappropriate relationship or something. And so I just asked Dr. Tripp. I was really kind of shaken by it, and I just said, I don't understand why. These spiritual giants, or at least those who seem to me like they are spiritual giants, why are they so easy to fall? I'll never forget what he said. He kind of sat back and he thought for a second and he stroked his mustache, because y'all remember that one, right? It's a doozy. Right? He just strokes his mustache and he said two things. He said, number one, he said, I noticed that all these guys, they begin to separate themselves from peer community. He said, now I use the word peer community, peer, because they are extroverts and they almost always have people around them. He said, but I mean peer community where somebody can look into their lives and say, that's not right. Somebody who is their equal, somebody that doesn't report to them or worship them. He said that, and then that's compounded by the second problem, and that is they forget. They think they've gotten past indwelling sin. And they think that because they've been successful in ministry and because God uses them, that they're somehow no longer susceptible to those early temptations that used to plague them when they were a young Christian. He said, and it just lies dormant until the right moment, and then it springs up and it overtakes them. One of the best decisions I've ever made, and I've told y'all this, was moving into a neighborhood together with a group of friends, not into the same house, obviously, but you know, in different homes in the neighborhood. These are people who can see into my life. They notice the weeds in my heart. They ask about them. And they helped me pull them up. Now, some of you are like, well, that's not a possibility for me right now. That's just one way to apply this. The point is, there are things that you can do to open up your life to other people. For example, I know of one single guy in our church who was struggling with a porn addiction. And so his friend said, you know what? I'm moving into your apartment with you for a month. That's pretty radical, but it helped. It helped. Are people close enough to you to speak into your life? Just be honest. When is the last time a friend told you, just looked you in the eye and said, that's a stupid decision? You know, if you do this, it's gonna hurt your relationships. It's gonna hurt your marriage. It's gonna hurt your testimony. Or they said something to you like this. That just doesn't seem like a wise use of your money. Hey, I'm not sure it's immoral, but is that the wisest thing to do? Or they just said to you, I'm not sure this is the wisest relationship for you to be in right now. When's the last time somebody told you something like that? If you can't remember a time, there are two possible explanations for the reason you can't remember. Even number one, you're just so perfect that you don't need that kind of critique anymore. The other possibility is that you haven't let people in close enough to see what's going on or given them permission to speak. and my money's on that latter one. This friendship shielded David. Here's the second thing it did. It strengthened David. Jonathan spoke courage into David's life when David was ready to give up. He reminded David that God had great plans for his life, even when David's world seemed to be collapsing around him. True friends multiply your strength. God designed our hearts to work that way. This is fascinating. I was reading this book called Locking Arms by Stu Weber. And he points out that when geese fly in a V formation, you look up there and you see them in the sky in a V formation, they do that because they add at least 71% flying range when they fly than they do when they fly on their own. 71%. And that's because the wings of the bird in front of them create an updraft that makes flying easier. So all the birds in the V are benefiting from the draft coming from the one in front of them. You say, well, what about the poor sap in the front? Yeah, that one meets all the wind resistance. But if you watch them for a while, and usually we can't see this, but each one only does that for a mile or two. And when he gets tired, he just rotates to the back of the formation and another flies point for a while. You say, well, that's just birds. I mean, come on, man, birds aren't real. Okay, all right, here's an example from the animal world. The strongest horse in the world right now can pull about 5,000 pounds. They can pull a sled weighing about 5,000 pounds. If you harness two horses together, though, as a team, just the two of them, they can pull over 14,000 pounds. Putting two horses together doesn't just double their strength, it multiplies their strength. And that's just because God made us in the animal kingdom, the bird kingdom, the human kingdom. He made us so that our strength multiplies when we pull together with a friend. I don't know about you, but knowing somebody else, y'all, is grieving my problem. And that's rare, I'll admit it, to have a friend that really grieves my problem with me. But when I know that a friend is grieved about my problem with me, worrying about it with me, it just makes my soul feel so much lighter, doesn't it? Have you experienced that? One of the greatest experiences of my life is when somebody looks at me and genuinely says, you got a friend in me. You got troubles, I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, we see it through because you got a friend in me. That's an old hymn, right? And that, no, I'm just kidding. That's Woody from Toy Story. But it's true, but it's true. Close friendships sustain and strengthen us. Interestingly, I was rereading something Tim Keller said the other day about marriage. I thought this was fascinating. He said, in times of distress, it's not the romantic parts of the marriage relationship that help. In times of distress, it's the friendship part. Tim talked about going through one of the most difficult seasons of his life, and he says in the middle of that difficult season, it dawned on him, his wife helped sustain him, not because she was his wife, but because she was his friend. He said, what I needed during that time wasn't sex, wasn't a roommate, wasn't somebody who I shared a bank account with. What I needed was a true soul friend. And that should be an encouragement, by the way, to all of you, to all of us, whether you're married or not, because it means that what is most helpful to us in times of need is something available, not just to married people, it's available to non-married people. What you need is a friend. And so Dr. Keller says to married people or to those looking to get married, you must do everything possible. You must pay any price to be best friends with your spouse. Good marriages, he says, are not basically romance garnished with a little friendship. Good marriages are friendships that are garnished with a little romance. And for those of you who are not married, it means that the most sustaining parts of marriage are available to you. It's not sex or sharing a bed, it's a friendship. Listen, y'all, God said, it's not good that man should be alone, but you understand, marriage is not the only way that we stop being alone. In fact, in some ways, friendship, eschatologically, or when you look into the future, is more important than marriage, because while marriage is only temporary, friendship is eternal. So this friendship shielded him, it strengthened him. Lastly, it shaped him. Later on, we're gonna see David show extreme generosity and selflessness with others. After tragedy had struck Saul and Jonathan's house, David asked if there was any of Jonathan's descendants that he could show kindness to. And David found that Jonathan had one living relative, a little boy named Mephibosheth. But this little boy was crippled, and David said, bring him to my table. He will never lack anything. And for the rest of his life, David treated Mephibosheth like a son. That's a generosity of spirit he learned, at least in part, from Jonathan. Jonathan's character shaped David's character. That's what Proverbs says will happen. Again, you notice how much I'm quoting Proverbs. This is all stuff that David learned from Jonathan. He that walks with wise men shall be wise, but the companion of fools shall be destroyed. I've heard Craig Groeschel, another pastor, say that this verse means that there's one thing in your life right now that I can look at that can help me accurately predict your future. You know what that is? Not your New Year's resolution list. The one thing I can look at to predict your future is who your close friends are. The one who walks with wise men becomes wise. The companion of fools, they're headed to destruction. Craig says, he says, you show me your friends and I'll show you your future. Because you become the average of your five closest friends. Look at your five closest companions right now. You're going to become the average of them in the days to come. You say, well, that's depressing. Yeah, the good news in that is that if you want to change your future and you're not sure where to start, you have a very actionable step. Change your close relationships. I often say to you, it's not the dreams you dream that determine your destiny. It's the small decisions you make. And one of those most important decisions is who you do life with, who you walk closely with. When I'm preaching at a student camp like I did this summer, on that last night, right? You give the invitation and all of them make decisions to follow Jesus. It's always this crazy emotional night. They haven't slept all week. The worship band plays extra long. You tell one emotional story and they all come forward. All right, and they come saying, I'll do whatever Jesus wants me to do. And I always tell them that the difference in those who continue on with the decision and those who falter in it is simply determined by who goes home and changes their friendships. Everybody at camp's on a spiritual high. Everybody feels the same. They're all like, oh, let's be missionaries. Let's not date till college. Let's memorize the whole Bible. I mean, that's what they all say. The difference in those who make it and those who don't has nothing to do with the intensity of emotion at camp. It's who follows up that emotion by changing the friendships. You don't change your friendships. You won't change. I don't care how much you cried, because you just become the average of your five closest friends. Craig Groeschel says, he said, we all have something we'd like to become. You want to be a better student. You want to be a better worker. You want to be a more solid Christian. You want to be a better parent. What if the decision to become that was really a decision about what friends you chose? You are one friend away from changing the course of your destiny. You're one friend away from being a better parent, being a better spouse, a better Christian, one friend away from being a better one of those or a worse one. You say, well, JD, are you saying that I should kick all my bad and mediocre friends to the curb? You asking me to go home and unfriend a bunch of people on Facebook? Will you at least give me a whopper if I do that? No, I am not saying that, okay? Do not send me a screenshot with a bunch of unfriend notifications and ask me for a burger. Here's a little graph that I've used over the years that I borrowed from Andy Stanley. I've changed the words a little bit, but I think this is a great concept. He talks about three kinds of friends that most of us have in our lives. The center one is what we call our core friends. Those are those one or two Jonathans. And they should all be Christians. They should all be people that you want to be like. That's your core. Then you got outside of that your community. That's the 12 to 15 people that you just do life with. The majority of those ought to be Christians, not all of them necessarily, but the majority of those, because that's your community. And then you've got the circle of concern. Those are people that you genuinely are friends with. You love them. You're involved in their lives, but they're just in that circle of concern. And for some of you, you've got to rethink who's in the core, and you've got to kind of move some people to community and concern. By the way, you don't officially tell somebody when they move to a different circle. Okay, but I'm just saying that's a helpful thing for you to think about. Friendships are important because they shield us, they strengthen us, and they shape us. And that's how God designed us. And so I'll say it again. Y'all, it should disturb us how little value we seem to place on friendship in our culture and how few friends most of us have, even in the church, particularly as we get older. Proverbs 18:1, an isolated man seeks his own desire and rages against all sound judgment. It is a tragedy that so many men have no real friendships in their later years. And that's why so many of them go wrong in that last chapter. They get apathetic, they get selfish, they get self-absorbed, bitter, controlling. After a good life, you men will squander the best years of your life in selfishness and darkness. It's because of a lack of friends. You are not too good for that to happen to you. Finally, number three, the story shows us the power behind friendship. Friendship is inspired by Jesus. Y'all think about it, Jonathan served David, even at great personal cost to himself. When David was in need, Jonathan walked 30 miles to warn him. Jesus, of course, came much farther than that. Jesus crossed the gap between eternity and earth, between deity and humanity. Jonathan gave up his right to the palace to put David in. Jesus purchased our place in the palace at the cost of his blood. Jonathan was not even the rightful heir to the throne anymore, but Jesus was the rightful heir to the throne, and he gave it up anyway. Like Jonathan, Jesus laid aside his royal robe and he took off the belt of his rights and the sword of his judgment, and he gave them all to us, even though he was the rightful heir and we were the traitor. And then when we turned our back on him and betrayed him, he refused to walk away from us, even when he had every right to. What a friend we had in Jesus. What a friend we have. Jesus' friendship, see, to you, enables you to become that kind of friend to somebody else. I love how Crawford Loritz, the daddy of our own Brian Loritz here, Pastor Brian, he said, how can you be this kind of friend that we see here in 1 Samuel? He says, the only way is you gotta be overwhelmed with the friendship of Jesus Christ. Jesus gave his own life, his own sword, his own robe so that you could be saved. And in doing so, he transformed you. He transformed your friendships. Or how about this? What do you do when a friend disappoints you? When you feel the need for a friend, but they just let you down. We all feel this sometimes. In the Psalms, David reveals multiple times when a friend or close family member disappointed him. Psalm 55 is a good example. He lamented a deep betrayal he had experienced at the hand of a friend. He was like, yo, if it was an enemy who'd done this to me, I could bear it, but it was my companion. It was my close friend. Some of you have been through that. It was a friend betrayed you. I'll tell you, few things hurt worse than that kind of betrayal. Or maybe for you, it wasn't a betrayal. Maybe they just were unaware of or not paying attention to your needs. They didn't call when they should have called. They didn't reach out when you needed them. They were just so preoccupied with themselves or their families that they didn't seem to notice that you were hurting. We all experience that. Every earthly friend disappoints, even the best ones, even the Jonathans. And see, that's where you can lean on Jesus, not just as your example of a friend, you can lean on Jesus as your actual friend. A man of many companions, David says, Solomon says, may come to ruin. But see, there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Closer than a brother. It's hard to get closer than a brother. Brothers are obligated to be there. This is part of the family code. But there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Because this friend was not only there for us, sympathizing with our pain. This friend took it in our place. He's a friend that will always shield and strengthen and sustain and shape us when others fail. Experiencing friendship with him enables you to be healthy and complete and non-needy and forgiving as a friend. I'll just go out on a limb here and say some of you can't forgive a friend who hurts you because you're so needy. So you're always nursing how others have let you down. It's why you can't be a good friend, because hurt people hurt people. And you're a hurt person, so you just hurt other people because you've been hurt. Your woundedness from past relationships makes you a bad friend to others. But see, when you find that completeness, that healing in Jesus, and you experience him as your faithful friend, you won't be so needy anymore, and you'll probably be able to more easily forgive those who hurt you. And you'll probably realize that you've hurt them also. You see, y'all, as with all things in the Christian life, healthy friendships start with Jesus. Summit Church, today is the day for you to make an intentional choice to pursue biblical friendships. You say, well, JD, where do I even start with that? I'll give you two connection points, okay? Very practical. Serving here at the Summit Church and small groups. Both are important, but I will tell you, our surveys show that the people who feel most connected, people who made those friends here, are the ones who serve. So I would start there. Go talk to somebody at your campus today, your campus pastor, somebody at the Next Steps area. Just go to the front page of our website or our app. Right now, today, you will see an invitation to the different ways you can connect at the Summit. summitchurch.com/connect, but again, it's on the front of our website. Just go to summitchurch.com and it'll be right there, or our app. As I close this, let me come back to the bigger point of this passage, the longer arc. Y'all, David is the rightful king. Saul opposes him and tries to kill him. Jonathan surrenders to him, even a great personal cost to himself. Jesus is God's chosen king for us. But see, for him to be king, you got to give up your claim to the throne. Only one person can be king in your life. Only one. Who's it going to be? By the way, after David became king, he poured out kindness on all Jonathan's house and gave him a permanent seat at the table and eternal inheritance in Israel. That's a picture of what happens when you surrender to Jesus. You might lose your earthly kingdom, something you couldn't hold on to anyway, but in its place, you gain an inheritance and a kingdom you can never lose. Have you made that trade? Y'all, I'd hate for you to leave here thinking about how to make better friendships, but still disconnected from Jesus. Because the whole point of this whole story is Jesus is God's rightful king. Have you submitted to him? Why don't you bow your heads, if you would. Bow your heads at our campuses. Let me just start right there. You can do that right now, if you've never surrendered to Jesus. He is God's king for your life, and he came bringing salvation. He'll give it to you, but you got to receive it. You would just receive it by saying, Lord Jesus, I know that you're the king, and I surrender to you. I receive you as my Savior. Listen, if you prayed that, make sure you tell somebody. Text the word ready to 33933 or tell somebody, one of those two things. For the rest of us, let me just ask you, what practical things should you change? Maybe it's getting involved in small group. Maybe it's volunteering. Maybe it's just being more intentional with the friends that you have. Summit Church at all of our campuses, why don't we stand to our feet? And as we do, we're going to worship and we're going to think about the friendship of Jesus and let that move us outward from here.